There have been some large battles to protect our environment, and one with deep connections to Wisconsin is the fight to ban the pesticide DDT. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and really great to have with me today in the studio Bill Berry. After he was over 20 years as a reporter, he's decided to redirect his energy to communicate about conservation and agriculture and learn and teach about private lands conservation. He is the author of Banning DDT, How Citizen Activists in Wisconsin Led the Way. Lives in Stevens Point with me today in the studio. And Bill, welcome to the program. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Larry. Glad to be here.
It's a fascinating book. And for me, it's, you know, I was a wet behind the ears, you know, guy just getting started and knew nothing, to be perfectly honest, at about the time this became an issue, the issue of DDT. So this book was really fascinating reading for me, and so many names, I was able to recall so many names at listening, reading about your writing. Just to begin with, I'm sure there are a lot of people that are at probably, I mean, everybody listening has probably heard the term DDT, but what was it really used for?
Well, it was originally invented in the 19th century and was considered to be like a sedative of all things, Larry. Then around the mid part of the next century, the 20th century, researchers saw that it had a lot of potential as a pesticide. And so its earliest uses were during World War II to ward off insect-borne illnesses in servicemen and women.
It was considered a miracle pesticide, wasn't it?
It was. It was very effective, and it saved a lot of lives in World War II from typhus and malaria and other diseases borne by insects.
What was it replacing, or was it just a revolutionary product? I guess it goes back so far that...
Well, it was revolutionary in its own right because it was broad spectrum and very effective, and that was part of the problem in the long run.
Yeah, what were some of the first indication that something was wrong, and who sounded that alarm?
Well, the first indications were back as far as late 1947, somewhere around there. Researchers with the Department of the Interior, including Clarence Cottom, who was an uncle of a professor here at UW-Madison, he started warning that DDT's persistence and its inability to break down in the environment were going to cause major problems. So he was among the first.
Yeah, and there were a lot of citizens that became as sounded warnings as well.
There were, and primarily that was because of the DDT's acute toxicity as a neurotoxin, so would be sprayed in cities and villages across the eastern United States to fight Dutch elm disease, and the next morning people would see robins and other songbirds flopping around on their boulevards.
Yeah, Dixie Larkin and Lori Otto.
Dixie Larkin was one of the earliest activists from the Milwaukee area, and she really sounded some early alarms. Then Lori Otto jumped into the fray, and anybody who knew Lori Otto realized once she dug her heels in, she wasn't going to back off from anything. So she was a housewife in Bayside, and she brought attention to village officials about the deaths of songbirds. Carried in a basket of 24 robins to the village manager there, and really started to stir things up.
Yeah, she was, and I'll just as an aside, she was often on this program, contributed many, many times, and it was a real loss when she passed on. But man, she got some pretty good experience just fighting in her own community, as you point out in your book. She and her husband lived on some property that abutted some pretty interesting land.
Right, the Fairy Chasm, as it was called, and so that one of her first efforts was to preserve that from development. And of course, as you know, Larry, she was also considered a national and international figure in the natural landscaping movement. And she had some battles with the village there. One time they mowed her natural landscape yard down.
When she was out of town.
When she was out of town, exactly. And, well, she wasn't going to back off there. She went and actually to the village and underscored the economic value of everything they had done, and they actually reimbursed her for that.
Yeah. talking today with Bill Berry. Really great to have him along as we talk about Wisconsin's connection to the battle against DDT. Bill Berry wrote the book Banning DDT, How Citizen Activists in Wisconsin Led the Way, and give you a chance to join in too with your questions or comments, or maybe you were around and remember those battles. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. That's our Facebook page for this program, the Larry Mueller Show. Carol in Glendale, we're going to give you a chance. Hi, Carol. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Yes. Well, I'm so glad to hear you about the DDT and Lori Otto. And, you know, she died some years ago, but one of the things after the DDT, she was very much against lawns and chemical use for lawns. So apart from the DDT, you know, part of our problem today now is runoff from lawns and such. And Lori was a huge advocate of other kinds of means for lawn maintenance and to reduce that. But I'd like to certainly see some more effort behind that, because it was a strong point in her life. And then also with the thing of chemicals put in the earth, Lori opted for a natural burial, that her body would not be given to, you know, formaldehyde and other burial chemicals that would go into the earth. So she went in the most natural burial setting I have ever, you know, experienced. I was at her funeral, and so that was what she wanted to leave, was a message for us. I mean, she did the DDT thing, but she was very much wanting to get a movement going towards natural burial to reduce the amounts of chemicals put into the earth through our natural burial product. You know, so Lori Otto, I'm so glad to hear you. And the Citizens Natural Resources Association, which Lori was a part of, they formed specifically to deal with the DDT problem. And the organization is certainly still strong and looking for members, people who are interested in backing this kinds of movement.
You know, and certainly that organization is, you talk about that extensively in your book, Bill.
Yes, CNRA formed in 1950. They described themselves as a militant conservation group. I don't think you'd get very far in today's world describing yourself as that, but they were a group that formed from citizens concerned about a number of conservation issues, and they played a key role in the DDT battle. They were actually the group of Wisconsin citizens that brought this to an administrative hearing.
You know, you do, I think, a nice job of setting the stage, or what was it like at the time of this, you know, in terms of how we approached chemicals and how we approached research and so forth. Just, can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, you know, we're still learning an awful lot about how we use chemicals, as you know, Larry.
Yeah.
And you know, after World War II, DDT was repurposed and used for a variety of reasons across the United States. And it took us a while to figure out just what was happening because of its persistence in the environment, and it concentrated as we went up the food chain into raptors, fish species, a whole variety of other life forms. And so we learned an awful lot during that period, and one of the benefits of that whole effort was a better understanding of when and how to use pesticides. Integrated pest management was born of that era. So I have the curse of the journalist, as do you, Larry. We have to see both sides of this, and I don't think we're ever going to eliminate chemicals, nor would we want to, from our lives. But, you know, we're still learning, and there's, you know, every day there's research coming out about pesticides and other chemicals that merit our attention.
And thanks again for calling. I want to give Stefan in Juneau County a chance to join in. Stefan, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
Hello.
My grandmother was against it in 1950, and I thought, gee, grandma's pretty smart. I didn't realize that it went that far back, all the way to the previous century or two centuries. But here in Juneau County, they use it against mosquitoes. And it was before the Nile was in mosquitoes. So it's not every city in Juneau County that does it, but somebody ought to check it out and see who's using it and who isn't.
Yeah, I'm positive that DDT itself is not being used in Wisconsin. Bill?
You never know, Larry. I would doubt it, but Stefan may have some information that other folks don't. And if, one way to address it would be to contact the DNR and have them look at it, because it has been banned in the United States since 1972.
Yeah, so if they are using it, Stefan, they are breaking the law. And if you have some kind of knowledge about that, you should get a hold of the Department of Natural Resources. I wouldn't doubt that there are some chemicals that are being used for mosquito, that may be used for mosquito control, but I'm pretty sure that they wouldn't be using DDT. Although,
you never know.
You never know. But please go ahead and check that out with the local DNR. I really want you to do that. Thanks for calling. Ron in Abrams, it's your turn. Ron, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hey, good morning. I just wanted to make a comment about Monsanto coming along with worse elements, I think, that they're using nowadays for crop weed control and so on. That's much worse than DDT. That's getting into our food supply, that people are unaware of it and how bad it is. And it just seems that they've got enough money and input in our government to go on and use these things without any kickback on it. And I think that should be looked into much more, just like DDT was. And I think what we're going to have to do as the public is run up against them and make them stop using it. The word is that they just get stronger and stronger every year, because the weeds get stronger and stronger every time they change their
formulas. Yeah. Bill, a comment?
Well, Ron is on to an important topic. That is, Monsanto and other companies have developed Roundup Ready crops. Roundup is glyphosate, the most commonly used herbicide in America. And so when we went down the path with Roundup Ready crops and the use of glyphosate, guess what? Weeds became resistant to it. And a matter of a couple weeks ago, the Environmental Protection Agency approved a combination for the first time of glyphosate and 2,4-D. And in the Vietnam War, we knew 2,4-D as Agent Orange. The chemical companies maintain that this is a much improved substance. But so now we have what they call Enlist Dual, which puts these two chemicals together. I might point out that 2,4-D has been pretty closely linked to Parkinson's disease and other maladies.
And, Ron, I thank you again for calling. I appreciate it. Taking a look at Wisconsin's connection to the battle against DDT today with my guest, Bill Berry, author of Banning DDT, How Citizen Activists in Wisconsin Led the Way. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at Wisconsin's connection to the battle against DDT, Bill Berry's book, Banning DDT, How Citizen Activists in Wisconsin Led the Way. The book published, by the way, by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. A great press, and great to have him on to talk about it. If you would like to join in, the number 1-800-642-1234. Go to our Facebook page. The title of our Facebook page is The Larry Mueller Show. You can certainly go there and post your questions or comments. And as a matter of fact, Facebook comment from Jennifer, how about the impact of DDT on the peregrine falcon? And as you point out, you've got quite a story in your book about that, Bill.
Well, yeah, and that takes us to one of my favorite characters in the history of Wisconsin conservation, Joe Hickey, wildlife biologist at UW-Madison, who sort of unlocked that secret as to why raptors in general and the peregrine falcon were in decline. Very quickly, Joe, as a young man, surveyed a number of 200 falcon eyries or nests in the northeastern United States. And later, when he went back, when we were trying to figure out what was happening to raptors, he had some graduate students go back there and look at these nests, and they identified 140 of them, and not one of them had any birds in them. And the reason was because the eggshells were too thin. The birds weren't able to metabolize enough calcium, and so we had thinning eggshells, and so there went the raptor populations.
Yeah, and so the issue, or as you talk about, was how to prove this sort of thing, and Joe, of course, had a...
Yes, Joe held a 1965 Peregrine Falcon Conference here in Madison, and was attended by scientists from across the country and Europe. At that time, they really didn't know what was happening to raptor populations other than they were in steep decline. Everybody thought it could be anything from disease to predation to egg collectors to hunting, you name it. But pesticides were always in the mix there. And so Joe, working together with some researchers from England, sort of developed a theory that was eggshell thinning. And so he sent a graduate student named Dan Anderson on a grand journey across the United States to find eggshell collectors who had pre-DDT eggs, eggshells in their possession. Of course, it was illegal to have then. Collecting eggs had been illegal for a long time, so... Joe Hickey or Dan Anderson had to sort of schmooze his way into their homes and get them to show him the eggshells. What he did clearly show with that little journey was that the eggshells prior to DDT usage were much thicker than those after.
Yeah, absolutely. Dennis in Wautoma, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi. I was fortunate this morning to see one of the benefits of banning DDT. I was in Marinette County driving along the Peshtigo River, and I saw a bald eagle perch near the river.
That's a very good point, Bill. I know you've got a comment on that.
Well, Dennis, during the mid-1960s, we were down to fewer than 100 pairs of bald eagles. Today, I think we had most recently... something like 1,400 active nests in the state. And I might add, Dennis, that just yesterday I looked out in my backyard and I saw a merlin, a small falcon, hunting some songbirds by my feeder. And so I had not seen a merlin in my yard before, so I looked it up at the Cornell Laboratory, a great bird site, and learned that they also were in steep decline in the 1960s and 70s, and they have returned thanks to... our more judicious use of pesticides.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. Yeah. Thanks, yeah.
What was once a rare sighting of a bald eagle is now pretty common up here, and I've noticed a lot more American kestrels also.
Yeah. Well, all those raptor-type birds have come back. I think almost all of them have come back.
Most of those that were impacted by DDT have made recoveries. Often humans have helped them a lot. The peregrine falcon would be an example. Many of the peregrine falcon nests in the Midwest are atop of power plants and other other tall buildings, often with the help from the power industry to help facilitate that.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
Humans have played a hand.
Thanks, Dennis. Rick in Madison. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, this conversation is bringing back fond memories when I was a child in the 60s visiting my grandparents in Portage. We always used to run after and chase the fogger truck down the street and loved being in the fog. And I'm just wondering what kind of ailments are attributed to DDT in humans and what are my chances?
Uh-huh. Well, I'm not a doctor, Rick, but I will say that many people who were youngsters in the 1960s and early 70s recall running behind those fogger trucks, dancing in the fog. And anecdotally, I've heard an awful lot of things. One, you know, studies are still coming out to this day. For instance, earlier this year, a report said that people with high levels of exposure to DDT were four times more likely to have Alzheimer's disease than people with low levels. You know, these are the types of things that continue to emerge as we understand pesticides better.
Yeah. Thank you again for calling, Rick. I appreciate it. I want to give Mark in Scandinavia a chance to join in. Mark, hello to you.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment on some of the pesticide manufacturers used to put DDT in mixes as a, quote, inert ingredient up to about 20 years after the ban. They were still sneaking it in. Maybe they had a lot of product to get rid of. And I can't remember who was the one who exposed that, but I remember reading it in the paper when I was a student down there.
Yeah. So our caller might still have been correct about it being used. Hopefully not today, but it's you're not seeing it now, Mark. I don't believe.
No, I don't think so. But because it was the inert ingredients, they're not required to list them all.
Yes.
So you can put all sorts of goodies in there and then, you know, surprise people.
Mm. Thanks for calling. And as a matter of fact, as you point out in your book, even though it's banned here in the United States, DDT still is used in some countries.
It is, especially countries that have malaria problems, and there are a lot of them in undeveloped countries. And really, some of the scientists and the activists involved with DDT, banning DDT in Wisconsin in the 1960s, to this day will say that there may be some limited use, especially in those countries that are fighting malaria. For instance, the walls of the small homes where people live could be sprayed with DDT to some beneficial impact, but you know it's so persistent and it causes such ecological havoc that it's a really dicey proposition.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Mark, for calling. You can join in too, by the way, talking with Bill Berry, author of Banning DDT, How Citizen Activists in Wisconsin Led the Way. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can go there and post on. And we had an email from Sue in Arlington. Is it correct that DDT is still being produced by American chemical companies for export to the other countries where it's been banned?
To my knowledge, Larry, that has pretty much ended, and there are companies that are. It did happen for a long time, but it is kind of it was not a good economic proposition for a lot of chemical companies, and most of the DDT in use in the world today is produced outside the United States.
Mike in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Mike. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. You're welcome. My question was, how long? There's always a period of denial, you know, associated with science becoming accepted, and we're seeing this with climate change, of course. But with DDT, how long did it take before or after they found out that it was thinning the eggshells of raptors? How long did it take the politicians to ban it after that?
Well, Mike, a good point about our human imprint on the globe and our inability to sort of react as rapidly as we should. One thing the DDT story tells us is that humans are capable of a tremendous global imprint. So in about the mid-1960s, Joe Hickey and others really sort of proved without a doubt that DDT was causing eggshell thinning and other problems. By 1967 or so, there were a lot of efforts to begin to ban DDT. Really one of the things that tips the scales in Wisconsin and elsewhere was when we found out that DDT was present in virtually all of the water bodies in Wisconsin and in the aquatic life therein. And so thanks to Gaylor Nelson and others pushing at the federal level, DDT was banned in 1972. So we're looking at maybe a 10-year period at maximum between the time we started to see these obvious impacts of DDT and the time it was banned. It was banned by William Ruckelshaus, who I might point out was first secretary of the Environmental Protection Agency, Richard Nixon appointee.
Yeah. And, of course, your book outlines the whole history of this and the famous hearings that were held in Wisconsin about it.
Right. 1968, a hot year in the United States for a lot of reasons. We had everything from the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy to the Chicago riots, you name it, with civil rights actions all across the country. So 1968, this little band of citizens finally got their chance to test the use of DDT because they claimed it was a water pollutant. So the DNR hearing administrator, Maurice Van Susten, scheduled a hearing. The first hearing was, date of the hearing was held at, I think, December 6th over at the Assembly Chambers of the Wisconsin Capitol, got national and international attention, and the hearing went on for 6 months, on and off for 6 months, and it really engendered an awful lot of national and international attention.
And brought people to Wisconsin from all over. That was it Sweden?
Yeah, one of the researchers who had a key impact, Laughrin, was brought in from Sweden. And, of course, we had to find a way to pay for him. So Freddie Ott, a Milwaukee business operator, a businessman, and a Peregrine Falcon lover, and a few others raised an awful lot of money to make that possible. And a lot of people right here in Madison, Milwaukee area, opened their homes to these scientists, gave them places to stay, fed them, and made it possible to have that hearing take place.
Yeah, Laureato was one that was involved in some of that fundraising too, and there were the Schlitz Company, there were several big name companies that as you point out in your book,
the Pulikers of M&I Bank in Milwaukee, as you said, a lot of the Uline family, a number of what we would call old Milwaukee wealth, really jumped on the bandwagon. Thanks to Fred Ott, primarily, whose family had old Milwaukee wealth himself from the grocery business. So it was just an example of where people from all walks of life participated in this effort.
And we're talking about a lot of money. I mean, even today, it sounds like a lot of money that they had. Is it, what, $250,000 or something like that? Or they?
Well, it sort of varies. You know, it as high as $250,000. Some people say less. I tend to think it may have been a little less than that. But the one person who had to be paid was the attorney for the Environmental Defense Fund. That was Victor Yannicone. And I imagine he charged a pretty good rate for his services and did a pretty good job.
Yeah, he was a pretty bristly guy.
Yeah, he was a fiery attorney, a brilliant legal mind. You know, and one of the side stories of this book is I was getting near the end of writing it, and I just assumed, which you should never do, that Victor Yannicone had passed, but I thought, I should check this out. So sure enough, I found where he was there on Long Island, called him up, and he answered the phone himself at his law office on a Friday afternoon, and we had a great conversation, very insightful. He actually claimed that Maurice Van Susten, the hearing examiner, the DNR hearing examiner here, was one of the most brilliant legal minds that he had ever come across.
Interesting. Very interesting. Hey, it was... his role in the book is really interesting to read. Steve in Beaver Dam, hi, thanks for calling.
Well, thank you. Very interesting program. I very much enjoy it. But there was a chemical mistake made when he suggested that when he actually said 2,4-D and Agent Orange were the same. That is incorrect. It's actually the main ingredient of Agent Orange was 2,4-5-T.
Ah.
They're absolutely two different chemicals. And I know this because I'm from that time period and in college. In the 60s, Chemical Engineering News had an article on Agent Orange. And it wasn't so much the chemical that hurt people, it was the high levels of dioxin that went to Vietnam because they wanted to dump the dioxin somewhere because they couldn't leave it here.
Oh.
So it went in the Agent Orange. It went into Vietnam. And that was what the whole article was about. But 2,4-5-T was the chemical, not 2,4-D.
Okay. Well, that's not what Ribeacher shows, Steve, but, you know, maybe both of them are being used. I do know that 2,4-5-D has been banned, while 2,4-D is still in use, registered for use in the United States.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks, Steve, for calling. I appreciate it. Mabel in Duluth, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Mabel.
Hi. All this talk about DDT, I remember as a child, I was born in North Dakota, and I left there in 1954 when I was 12 years old. But I remember so vividly in the summertime when there'd get to be a lot of flies in the house. My mother would put dish towels over the crocks of clabbered milk that she would use to make cottage cheese. We'd all go outside, and she'd just spray that house down liberally to kill the flies. And, of course, she put the dish towel so the flies wouldn't fall in the milk. And we'd come back in that house, and it was just full of DDT. And then my brother, who lives in Portland, Oregon now, he's about 20 years ago maybe, had a kidney transplant. And he told me that the doctors suspected, because he'd been around DDT so much, spraying it on the grain elevators to keep the rats away out there, that might have caused his kidneys to fail.
Oh. Probably a few more than one story like that out there. Mabel, thanks for sharing it. I imagine you came across some of those stories, Bill.
I sure did, and anecdotally I continue to as I go around the state making presentations. Almost every time I make a presentation, someone talks about something anecdotal that happened to them or a family member. I got a call from or email from a doctor in Dodgeville a while back who said one of the favorite times of his life was working for the city of Madison in the 1960s while a college student, spraying DDT for mosquito control in marshes. He said it was a great job, except at the end of the summer, the six young college men who were doing the spraying all had developed sort of a quiver in their hands, probably from the acute toxicity, the neurotoxic part of DDT. So lots of stories like that, and lots of home uses of DDT, the bug bombs, as we say.
Yeah, absolutely. Kristen in Eau Claire, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi, I have a three-part question. The first being, how would you characterize the use of chemicals in the States or in the United States since the ban of DDT? Along with, how would you characterize the EPA approval process for new chemicals, and are there any chemicals currently in use that are particularly worrisome due to their ecological imprint or effect on human health?
All right. So three big questions there for you, Bill.
Well, the first on the EPA approval process, you know, it's improved. There's no question about that. In the days of DDT approval, basically DDT was approved because they tested it on inmates at high doses, and so when they didn't die, we figured it was okay. So the process has gotten better. There are some problems. Warren Porter, for instance, zoologist here at UW Madison, points out that in the DDT approval process, we look at the main chemical within the pesticide mix, the compound, but we don't consider the synergistic effects of other chemicals that are also combined with the chemical that we're approving. Also, we sort of fall short when we come to assessing its impact on infants. And so I could go on, but let's see, we have some other callers here. Mm-hmm. Let's see, were there other questions there then, Larry?
We had the
concerns about today.
Yeah, today's chemicals.
Yeah, well, obviously it's ongoing. Just for instance, a fascinating study that came out earlier this year, the National Institute of Health, it didn't get anywhere near as much coverage as it should have, but what it said that basically it was a 20-year longitudinal study of farmers who apply pesticides. And what it found, that farmers who are applying certain types of pesticides or organochlorines, of which DDT was one, dieldrin another, and certain fumigants, suffer much higher rates of depression than people from other walks of life. So this information continues to roll out as we better understand our interaction with the chemicals that we use in our world.
Yeah, absolutely. Lori in Viroqua, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I'm interested in the scientists who worked on the DDT issue, and we're studying, you know, the effects of it, and it seems a lot of scientists who study chemicals now or genetically modified organisms are immediately smeared before they can, you know, if they question the safety of anything before the science can come out. There's a attack on the scientists themselves, and I'm wondering if that was happening back then or if that's a new development.
Well, one of the, I'm sorry, Larry.
Yeah, go, no, go
one
ahead.
One of the chapters in the book is called Joseph Hickey Wept, and it's a story that Gene Rourke, a longtime conservationist, told about his time as a student journalist at UW-Madison, interviewing Joe Hickey over at the College of Agriculture, where his offices were, saying that he had all this research on DDT, but he couldn't do anything with it because under orders of the dean, he was told not to release this information. And so at that point, he wept, which is hard to believe for people who know Joe Hickey, but I certainly trust Gene Rourke, and it's clear as you read Hickey's life story that he suffered a lot. He felt awful bad about this part of what happened to him. It's still happening to this day. And that's I guess, what we would expect.
Yeah. Although I think, you know, I'm hoping that scientists' roles or scientists, how scientists view themselves has changed considerably over the years. I probably, Bill, you'd agree with that.
I would agree. You know, and that's one of the lessons we learned from this whole episode. Science is always changing. You know, it's never reached its final conclusion, which makes it hard for some people to accept and easy to attack. But I think they're continuing to do good work.
Well, I tell you what, this has been by the way, are you giving some talks or do you have some things scheduled that we can let people know about?
I just finished one in Rhinelander, and then we're getting a little break here during the holiday season, but then in April we'll be out, or next spring we'll be out in several groups, and so it continues. More than happy to talk about this. I'd go anywhere to do so.
Have you a website or a place where people could go to get a hold of you?
Yes, I have a Facebook page, obviously, and also an email address, BillNick, BillNick, @charter.net. And so also you can contact the Wisconsin Historical Society Press, and they got a good bunch of people that will link us up.
Yeah, that's probably a great way to do it. And on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, too, we've got a link to the book and to the Historical Society. So, and that's a simple way to get back to you if someone would like to hear you speak and to learn more about the book. Been a great pleasure, Bill, and I have to tell you it was really a fun read for me, and you tell a really great story here, and I hope a lot of people get a chance to read it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry, and I don't want to steal your thunder here, but I know your next guest is with the Audubon Society. They played a huge role both in Wisconsin and nationally on the banning of DDT.
Yeah, absolutely, and we'll be talking, probably use that as a little bridge into the next program, as a matter of fact. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you, Larry.
Appreciate it very much. Bill Berry is the author of Banning DDT, How Citizen Activists in Wisconsin Led the Way, a fascinating read, and I hope you have a chance to take a look at it. Again, it's Wisconsin Historical Society Press, so it's pretty easy. Your local bookstore is going to be able to get it for you if they don't already have it in stock. And as he said, the Audubon Society played a kind of a key role back then in helping get DDT banned. Right now, they're looking at something else, and it has to do with climate change and how climate change is impacting our birds and our bird life. They've got some research to talk about with us, and I know you're going to want to listen to that research. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.